Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, sponsored by 1-800-DialDJs.com and recorded live on blogtalkradio.com from the new media and American League Baseball capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Not pleasant when a man's good fortune comes at the hands of another man's loss. I mean, what would you call it when you're the author of a new book about a Motown act, Diana Ross and the Supremes, that fizzled out more than 35 years ago, but another Motown star of that era, Michael Jackson, dies the week before your years of research are published, making your book front and center? Well, Mark Hrabowski didn't know Jackson was going to die, of course, and he certainly didn't know Jackson's will would name Diana Ross the likely guardian, and eventual guardian, perhaps, of his three children. The Supremes, a saga of Motown dreams, success, and betrayal, is not the first biography of the ultimate girl group, but it probably won't be hurt by its timing. Mark, welcome to Mr. Media.
Hi, Bob. How you doing?
Good. How about yourself?
Battling a little cold, but... Should be able to get through it, you know.
hopefully you won't need a shot or any heavy medication to handle this.
If I disappear, you know what happens, you know. No, I should be all right.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Hey,
I must say though, I disagree with you about there being other Supremes biographies. There actually haven't been, if you look closely. There have been sort of celebrity journalism, and I use that in quotes, books about Diana Ross, and of course there was Mary Wilson's Dream Girl, and you know, some books about Florence and this and that. But the reason I did this book is that there never has been a Supremes biography, at least one that, you know, goes into their music and on a microcellular level, and you know, describes why they became the Supremes and why they owned Motown and everything like that. But yeah. That's my. I just want to get that in. There had never been a real biography of this group, which is kind of scandalous, you know, considering they had the third most number one hits in history behind Elvis and the Beatles.
Well, and I was going to say, you know, you do say here, right in the introduction, and a number of people have pointed this out, that, you know, you call them the most important modern American music act after Elvis Presley, and well. I mean,
I in terms of hits, certainly empirically, you know, you might want to make that claim about the Doors, obviously, or you know, somebody like, or you know, the Birds or something like that. But on a strictly empirical level, they are the most successful, you know, female group in history. They've been tied for number one hits by Mariah Carey, believe it or not. But I wouldn't put those two in the same basket, you know.
Now, were you a Supremes fan?
I was without knowing it. I mean, I'll try to explain that. I was, you know, a little kid at the time, and certainly the music I loved. But, you know, a lot of guys probably wouldn't have admitted to being Supremes fans. I was more a girl thing. However,
yeah.
the reason you sell 12 number one records is not because you're popular among girls. You're popular among anyone who listens to music, and that's what happened with the Supremes. Regardless of the theme of the song, regardless of the Cinderella fable that they were trying to project, there was always that undertow in their songs, which was, you know, you can credit that to Holland, Dozier Holland, you know, and Berry Gordy and whatever. That the undertow of soul and convincing R&B and soul was at the bottom of every Supremes record. So yeah, for that reason, I never turned off a Supremes record when it came on the radio, and that's a pretty good deal, I think, for any group if you're able to say that, right?
Well, sure, and of course, if you're a guy, you know, and in a certain era, you wanted to, you know, spend time with a girl, probably would be in your interest to put up with Supremes songs, even if you weren't particularly a fan. Maybe you know, maybe you
would
prefer the Doors, but
But I wouldn't be doing it like, say, with the mermaids or something like that, you know.
Right.
You know, you got popsicles and icicles. I mean, it was real music. You know, anything that came out of Motown was real music, and that's the reason why the Supremes were able to flourish.
Right. I mean, I would have preferred, you know, to invest my time in the Temptations or...
Well, I'm doing a book about it. I'm doing a book with Otis. I'm doing a Motown trilogy. At this time next year, I'll have a Stevie Wonder book out to coincide with his 60th birthday. God, I can't hardly believe that. And then
Stevie.
And then the Temptation. I'm doing it with Otis Williams, the sole surviving Temptation. And that'll be out in the year after that. So I'm sort of Mr. Motown at the moment.
Huh.
And I agree with you about the Temptations. They were my favorite Motown group, bar none. Absolutely not a question. Because they didn't even try to compromise for crossover until later on. But even later on, they got into, you know, the psychedelic stuff with Norman Whitfield. And, you know, it was far out. You know, the Temptations were just, they broke them all. The Temptations actually maneuvered on a different orbit than everybody else at Motown. They were off on their own most of the time anyway. You know, so it was a whole different story. But the Supremes, certainly, I mean, they're in the loam of American pop culture. I mean, that's why when Diana Ross tried to get that tour together and she wanted to take five times the money that she was going to give Mary and Cindy, it didn't work, and the tour bombed. Because as popular as Diana Ross became, she'll always be a Supreme first. And that actually haunts her a little bit. Yeah, it really does. It's haunted her through the years that her popularity has actually run second to what it was with the Supremes. And that's saying something, too.
She, not exactly, not someone you really want to hang out with after, you know, reading a book like this. Or
Who is that, Diana?
Diana, it doesn't seem like, you know, one of the more pleasant people in show business.
I wasn't planning on hanging out with her, but you're probably right. Very loathsome. I mean, that's the thing that everybody talks about, even way before they were popular. And they went 3 years as nobodies, the no-hit Supremes, as they were called. Even back then, she's getting on people's nerves left and right, saying what she was going to be. I mean, this was an obsessed woman. She was even as a teenager. She knew what she wanted. She had no compunction saying it to anybody else. Even when they were nobodies, that they were going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show, she was going to be as big as Eartha Kitt. She was going to change the world. She was going to be a movie star and a solo star. Everybody laughed at her, but who had the last laugh, right? See, the thing about Diana is people have been saying in reviewing this book that I have some sort of axe to grind against Diana. Well, I really don't. I give her all the credit in the world. There would never have been a Supremes with anybody else as a lead singer. She was able to formulate the Holland Dozier Holland template better than anybody conceivably could have. And I do give her a lot of credit for her generosity and kindness, which unfortunately was overshadowed by her obsession to be the diva. She never actually let anybody see that side of her, which was a shame, which is why so many people don't like her. And maybe you're right. I mean, I never met her, but I would imagine she's not the most pleasant person to be around.
I remember
she certainly wasn't the Mary and Flo, you know. So.
Right. I was going to say, I remember covering a concert that she did during the On Coming Out days in the mid-'80s when I was just a music critic for the St. Pete Times. And there was a point in the – I cannot find the review, but there was a point in that where it was just so Miss Ross. You know, it was like
– Oh, yeah, yeah.
She was so – the diva was just flying, and she kept stopping the song because it wasn't right and starting over and stopping and start, and people were just like, oh, my God, let me the hell out of here.
I mean, listen, no, that's her in a nutshell. You know, it's a temperamental genius. I think a lot of times she played that up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They sort of, you know, I'm the diva and you can't, don't forget about it. And maybe even felt a little embarrassed that she was doing that. But she also fused into it so easily it was hard to tell. You know, she always had that. Yeah, really. I mean, it was like, you know, snap of a finger and then would be. Yeah, I call it in the book the good Diana and the bad Diana. And the good Diana was in small doses, and the bad Diana was in large doses. But what can you? I mean, you can't argue with success, right? So she knew what she was doing.
Is that like the good Hitler and the bad Hitler?
Oh God. I'm sure there are a few at Motown in the 60s who would have made that connection.
Yeah.
They would have made any connection. They really did not like Diane, especially the other girl groups who she was so jealous of anyway, the Marvelettes, Martha and the Vandellas. She had memorable feuds in the early days. First with Gladys Horton of the Marvelettes, whom she almost ran over in a parking lot one day after a concert. It's a great story. Read the book. and Martha, whose clothes she stole, basically. You know, this was Diana Ross. She would see what other girl groups were wearing, and if she thought they were really nice, she wouldn't tell anybody, but she'd have a tailor make up the same dresses for the Supremes, who'd go on first, leaving Martha and the Vandellas and the Wings to like, steam. And Martha barged into her dressing room. They were going to have it out. But Diana could always defuse a situation like that by doing one thing, picking up the phone and calling Berry Gordy. And that always did the trick. He was enthralled to her. He would do anything. He'd jump through hoops for her, which was so funny because at the beginning, you know, he's like 15 years older, and he was a pro of the industry. And at the beginning, here's this 17, 18-year-old girl who had him wrapped around her finger. They could not believe that at Motown. They just could not believe that he was so enthralled to her that he would let her get away with anything, basically.
Gee, I wonder what she held over him.
Well, you know what she held.
I know. I should say held out to him, perhaps.
Yeah, make. let's say held out the prospect of, you know, because
yeah.
That's what he was after. And great story, you know, them consummating their affair, or, you know, for the first time in Paris on a Motortown Revue tour of England and Paris in 1965. It was, again, this is part of Diana's plan. She got there by warming up with Smokey Robinson and Brian Holland, you know, and Berry was the big prize. They had a love-hate relationship. Boy, that was a knockdown, drag-out thing. And it was complicated with the daughter that was born that they didn't tell the daughter the identity of her own father for 17 years because Diana thought it would be a stigma on her if that ever came out. See, these people are very different from you and me. You know, these people live in an ether. They live in you know, above the world that we live in. It's a fantasy world that they can make happen because of their money. They're not all there mentally, you know. They really are, but that's one of the reasons for their success, you know. They're able to make magic musically that way. I wrote a book about Phil Spector. It's the same thing, you know, the line between madness and genius. In music, it's particularly noticeable, you know, that line between madness and genius. It happens with every great musician, I think.
Hey, speaking of your Phil Spector book, which was
yeah.
he's a rebel, will there be an update to that now that he's been convicted?
Well, we've had three editions of it, and I think most people who are interested in that story know how it came out, and rather than going back and putting one sentence in at the end, you know, or something like that, just kind of leave. But you know, there might be more to the Spector story yet to come. We don't know what's going to happen in jail. He might hang himself in jail. He might, you know, he might be Bubba's wife. I mean, I don't know. You never know what's going to happen with him. He might die in jail, you know. So he might come out in his 70s or something, 80s, and be a TV celebrity somehow. You know the nature of celebrity,
yeah.
King of comedy, you know, the Robert De Niro movie. So you never know. There might be another chapter left to that story. Phil is the gift that keeps on giving. You never know.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction, I mean, did you in your wildest dreams ever imagine the string of events of the last 2 weeks?
Oh, no. Yeah. But you know what? I never would have expected, well, maybe I would have on some level expected Michael Jackson to die young, but recently Motown stars or figures have been dying off at an amazing clip. You know, Norman Whitfield and Levi Stubbs. A lot of the funk, I mean, the Funk Brothers, the house band at Motown, they made all that great music. Basically the same core musicians for years. There are only about two or three of them left. It's very tragic to me, being a big fan of that aspect of music. Hmm. You know, so a lot of people have been dying. Not Berry Gordy, though. I mean, he's going strong at 80. He might never die, that guy. He's living too well to die. But I never would have expected Jackson to die, I guess, right before the book came out. And, of course, people are asking about the relationship between the two. I don't think there ever really was one, to tell you the truth. The whole thing came about as a farce, as a scam. Diana Ross discovered the Jackson 5, which she never did. That was just a PR campaign. They were discovered by Bobby Taylor of the Vancouvers, a Motown group, who discovered them in Chicago and then produced their first album.
Now,
which was called Diana Ross Presents the Jackson 5. I mean, it was like enough already at that point, you know, trying to get people to think that she discovered them.
Well, why did this is the thing I wondered, even after reading, you know, in the book, why did Berry Gordy think it would be profitable to have her present them? Because Michael was a kid, and she was, I mean, it's not like she's the good mother figure, you know.
For that reason, and also because you have to remember it was 1969. It was the fall of 1969, right? And they were getting ready to gear up this huge PR machine for Diana Ross going solo. You know, the Supremes played their final concert in February at the Frontier Hotel in Vegas, and Diana went right into her solo career after that. So it behooved them both to have that cross promotion. And obviously, Diana Ross was Motown's biggest star by far, by light years. And, you know, the Jackson 5 were just a kid group. They might not have even been, you know, given any credibility at all, except for the Diana Ross Association. But it was just so ham-handed, trying to get people to believe she discovered them, and then she groomed Michael and all this kind of stuff. It's just unbelievable. But I tell you what, those early days must have left a big impression on Michael, because he had an obsession for Diana Ross, maybe not sexually. That's a whole other ball game with him. But maybe, you know, I think that all his plastic surgery was done to look like, to make him look like Diana Ross. The same cheek, you know, the eyes, you know, well, the nose got a little out of hand. But at the beginning, and then, you know, he would, you know, Dirty Diana, one of the titles, and stealing some of her inflections from the old Supreme songs. It's a weird dynamic with Michael and Diana, but I don't think they really were that close through the years.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to say Stevie Wonder was closer to Michael through the years. They collaborated on a couple of records through the years. You know, and Stevie produced Jermaine Jackson, and, you know, they were closer than Diana and Michael. I don't think Diana's really been close to anybody from Motown through the years.
Yeah, my sense of it from outside was that they weren't close until they did The Wiz, at which point, you know, they spent time as adults. And I think it was during the tribute, kind of was just yesterday, the tribute where they played a video clip of her talking to him, I guess, on the set of The Wiz, and she says, you know, I just never dreamed you were going to grow up to be this sexy. And he just recoiled at that. You know, it's just like
that's art imitating life, I guess, right there. But I was just making a movie together. I don't think they ever really hunkered down together and had heart to heart talks and stuff like that.
Well,
they were just so busy anyway. You're not in separate orbits when you're on that level anyway. So, you know.
Well, there must have. I mean, sometime after the Supremes, there must have been a time in their lives where they did get to be. I mean, you know, as I mentioned, I mean. He put her in his will to follow his mother, take care of his kids. I presume that indicates, you know, he had his choice of a lot of different people. I can't believe it was an accident or just an afterthought that he chose her. There must have been some connection.
Well, I don't want to get too cynical, but again, that's something that you do.
But he didn't do it to sell records.
No, not to sell records, but that's something you do when you want to establish a narrative, you know, that we were so close, Diana and I, and you want to die with that as one of the narratives of your life. But has she accepted that? I don't know. I don't even think she's said, oh yeah, of course I'll take the kids if I need to.
She said
she would be there for them or something like that.
Right.
But, you know. Yeah. So
I mean,
again,
how,
hey,
she,
even
she's
in
not much younger than Katherine Jackson, is she? I mean, how old is Diana?
She's 64, 65.
All right, so
born
she's
in 1944.
10 years,
yeah.
Ten years younger than.
Catherine is 79, right? Catherine Jackson.
Oh, see that? Okay,
I thought
she was early
70s.
All right, so yeah, there's a bit of an age difference.
Well, but she will never be the mother to those children. I can guarantee you that.
No, of course, no, of course not.
Yeah.
Now, speaking, let's come back to Diana.
Right.
The book. I mean, I think you'd agree. The book is kind of very gossipy, and it isn't always kind to Diana Ross. But does it break new ground?
I don't know that I'd call it gossipy. You have to cover certain things. You can't ignore who's sleeping with whom. You know, you can't just do the way these fanzine type articles have done through the years in these books. You know, where you say, well, they were just they had love on a certain level and blah blah. You can't. You have to do that. But there's really no gossip. That was, you know, I didn't have that in mind at all. I just wanted to tell the truth. Sometimes the truth hurts. I mean, I understand Gordy and Mary Wilson were, you know, they were frantic when they heard this book was coming out. But really, when you think about it, what could I have said that hasn't been said about them in the past, you know?
Well, I agree, yeah.
Gordy's been called a hustler, a street thug, a guy who ripped off his artists, which in fact is true, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Lived very well on the earnings of people from the ghetto of Detroit and never paid them anything near what they were worth. How many times has he heard that in his life? 1,000? So what would he be really upset about? But just goes to show you the egos of these people. You know, they get frantic when they think somebody's writing a book which is going to knock them. So, and Mary, I mean, look who's talking. I mean, her whole book was predicated on knocking Diana from page one, literally from page one. Dream girl. So who is she to talk, you know? Yeah, really, who is she to talk? But to get back to your question, it's just a matter of telling the truth, you know, because this is all part of the story. There would never have been a Supremes with 12 number one hits had Diana Ross not had the gumption, or whatever you want to call it, to hit on Smokey Robinson and hit on Brian Holland and then Berry Gordy. It's part of the story. Can't ignore it. A lot of people get very upset when you retell that story, but how could you not? So,
well,
you know.
I mean, I want to ask you about that. I mean, pop music fans, I know this from my years of writing concert reviews and doing interviews, they hold their idols pretty close. I mean, a lot of them feel closer to these people they will never meet than they do some family members. And
they absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, are you hearing negative things from, you know, Diana Ross's fans or Mary Wilson's fans, even Florence Ballard's fans, for that matter?
Funny you should mention that. I mean, I find it very amusing. Amazon.com has this thing where you're able, I guess Barnes & Noble too, where you're able, fans are able to leave their little 2 cents, you know, about the book, which is fine. This is as long as they have the real reviewers above that, which they do. And this book has gotten some spectacular reviews. You can go and you can see that. But it's so funny. These Diana Ross files, or whatever you want to call them, just tearing me to shreds. You know? Yeah, this guy, don't even come near him. He's bad news. He just wants to make Diana look bad. It's a horrible book. Don't buy it. You know, it's hysterical. And again, that comes from what you just mentioned. They really think on some level Diana is depending on them to uphold their name or something like that. And it's very funny, you know. That is the pop culture. That's human nature, you know. People who think that they're this close to Diana Ross because they've loved her through the years. It's fascinating.
Now, Florence, Flo Ballard is dead, of course, been dead a long time. Diana Ross and Berry Gordy clearly didn't cooperate with you on the book. Who or what were your primary sources?
Well, there were a few really, really good ones that have never really been quoted at length before, including the two Holland brothers, Eddie and Brian, the two mm-hmm. geniuses of Motown, the real backbone of Motown, who, you know, wrote and produced all the songs up to Love Child, all the Supremes hits, and also all the Four Tops hits, among others, Marvin Gaye, whatever, Martha and the Vandellas. They were fantastic. And in keeping with what I said before, I was able to get to a couple of the Funk Brothers, Jack Ashford, the tambourine and vibe guy, who was probably the premier font of Motown lore through the years, and he just was fabulous. I think the best source I had was Flo Ballard's cousin, Raymond Gibson, because Flo was from a big family. There were 14 boys and girls in the family, but she never was close to any of those brothers and sisters as she was to her cousin Raymond. And he was the one that she left all her memorabilia to, and left old tapes that had never been heard and pictures that had never been seen. And he really sketched the life of Flo Ballard the way it never had been before. And he provided the real insight why she was so unhappy. And I'm really grateful that he did that. He didn't have to, but he did. And he was probably the best source. And, of course, there were, you know, other Motown people. I talked to two of the Vandellas, and I talked to two Marvelettes, and people who were on tour with the Supremes, and a lot of people, probably about 50 people, you know. And Shelley Berger, the manager, who's still Diana Ross's manager and Temptations manager to this day. How's that for longevity, right?
Yeah.
Of course, they fired him a few times, but, you know, he came back. Wow. He's 75 years old, and he still calls Berry Gordy Mr. Gordy. So there you go. Loyalties don't die at Motown. So.
Now, right. Mark, I have to ask you. I make my living writing books, and yeah, every time you start on one or you turn one in and you go through acceptance, you think, oh, man, there was like 300 names in there, and you're just hoping against hope that everything is works out. And I have to ask you, and I did see this in the review. I was surprised someone else picked up on this. Now, I worked briefly about a decade ago on a proposed Michael Jackson book with someone you referenced 20 times in the book. I think you know who this is. That's the person that you named Tony Tucker, but is actually Tony Tucker.
Oh, yeah, and that is my...
What happened there?
That's my... Well, is it such a big deal? Yeah, we're... So I know I made a mistake. Tony Turner. That will be rectified in the next printing, obviously. Tony, if you're listening, from the female impersonating club or whatever, I profusely apologize to you. You know, I got your name wrong, but I don't think that really changes much. You know.
But the interesting thing is
if anybody actually notices, you know, because he wrote a book about the Supremes, which I referenced, in the book, which said a few things that were just wildly wrong. Not just a little wrong, but wildly wrong, you know. So,
well, he also did a book on the Temptations.
Temptations, right. Mm-hmm, exactly.
Right.
And that was horrible. It didn't even talk about the Temptations of the 60s, only in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Well, he wrote about when he was there.
Right, mm-hmm, exactly.
I think I know the answer to my next question then. I wondered if... I couldn't tell, actually, from the book. The references to him and to his work were from his book. You didn't actually interview Tony, I guess.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
No. Mm-hmm. Right.
All right. I was just curious about that.
No, I don't even think I could find him if I wanted.
Well, and, you know, it's funny. His name came up a couple of years ago, and I was thinking, I was trying to remember where. And when I looked at the book, I had to think twice.
I do. It's my fault. You know, it's my bad. What can I tell you? You know, that will be rectified in the future printings. And I apologize to.
Well,
Mr.
and that's why
Turner.
I frame.
Yeah.
Mr. Turner, and that's why I frame it the way I did because, I actually, like I said, I started working with him on a book, so I knew who he was. But I've worked on enough books to know that you always have that moment. And actually, I had a book come out 5 years ago, and a guy contacted me about 3 months ago, and he said, you got my late father's name wrong in your book. What are you going to do about it? I said, well, mm-hmm. I'm going to apologize to you, but there's nothing else I can do about it. It was 5 years ago.
What can you do? That happens in every book. I mean, the dumb little mistakes like that. I think my subconsciously I was thinking of you remember the fighter, Tony Tucker, fought Mike Tyson? Tony Tucker? Mm-hmm. So I think maybe that was in my mind. So, you know, again, yeah. Mr. Turner, I got your name right in the bibliography. So, you know. So, But I do apologize to him.
Now, before we wrap it up, I want to. You mentioned that you're doing two books. You're doing Stevie Wonder,
yeah.
And you're doing Temptations. I got to ask, with reference to Stevie Wonder, have you heard the interview that he did a couple years ago of all people, Howard Stern?
No, I should probably go get that. Was that worthy of?
It was.
Information on that?
You know? I guarantee it was the most unusual and revealing Stevie Wonder interview you will find, and if you haven't heard it, it'll be worth tracking. Now, they actually repeated it just a couple weeks ago in a best of week, so it's definitely.
What did he talk about? What did he talk about? Anything?
Talked about his songs. He talked about his sex life. He talked about
all
the women.
Well, there's plenty on his sex life. Yeah,
You know, it was coming right from him. It was interesting. It was very different, like you say, very different from like a fan. Biography or
Stern does great interview. Was that on his satellite show or the old show, the over the air show?
That's a good question. You know, he owns all those, so it was repeated on the Sirius show.
Well, maybe it's in his archive somewhere. I can find that, but that's
I'm sure. It is. Anyway, I just mentioned it to you. Sure.
Well, Stevie is definitely the horniest man in America. Let me say for the record.
I can believe that from that interview. Yeah.
Yeah. He claims at 8 years old, the horniest man in America.
That sounds like something he talked about. Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll be interested in that. I guarantee it.
I'm going to go look that up. Thanks.
It was unlike anything he did on the Mike Douglas show. Let's just say.
The Mike Douglas, he said on the Mike Douglas show once, I'm going to UCLA, and everybody bought it, and it was like a big joke. He never went to UCLA, you know.
That didn't happen? I'm shocked.
He was a great practical joker, Stevie, you know. Well, he used to feel up women at Motown, you know, under the pretense that he couldn't see where he was feeling, you know. But he knew exactly where he was feeling. He's got a sixth sense, man. He knows exactly what's in front of him, so.
Well, listen, folks, you can find Mark Hrabowski's book, The Supremes, A Saga of Motown Dreams, Success, and Betrayal, at great bookstores everywhere, or online at MR Media, MrMedia.com, and Amazon.com. And, Mark, I did not see. Are you on Facebook or Twitter, any of those kind of things? Where people can...
No. Well, I think I am, but I don't really. I just did it to get to see, you know, contact somebody else. You know what I mean? It wasn't for people to contact me, but I probably am. So if I get an email, it probably will come to my regular email. So, you know, you'll find me. You'll find me somewhere, you know. You'll find me somewhere on the Internet.
Yeah, he's out there.
I'm out there somewhere, you know.
Well, Mark, thanks so much for your good humor and for joining us on Mr. Media today. Good luck
on
with MySpace, the
book. MySpace, if that counts.
All right, MySpace.
MySpace, yeah. Thank you very much. And a year from now, let's do it about Stevie then, you know.
That'd be great. That would be very interesting.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Now, folks, for more interviews with musicians and music writers, you can surf over to MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com, where you can hear my earlier interviews with Gene Simmons of Kiss, with the late John Denver, as well as Ramones biographer Legs McNeil and Neil Diamond biographer David Wild, among many others. Please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media, or marking Mr. Media as one of your favorites, whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, TrueSlant.com, DigitalJournal.com, Podcast Pickle, MediaFly.com, Podfeed.net, Blueberry, Zencast, Zimbio, or Odeo. And subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. Or subscribe to Mr. Media's blog on the Amazon Kindle Reader. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. That's A-N-D-E-L-M-I-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate when you give up a piece of your day and share it with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening, everybody.